Welcome to the Diversity Remix, only provocative conversations at the intersection of business, politics, and culture. I'm Charlie Echeverry.
And I'm Jesus Chavez.
This week's episode, if you win, you're British. If you lose, you're black. In our deep dive, we take a look at racism in international soccer following the fallout from Euro 2021. What's the real economic, social, and performance impact of racism in the world's most popular sport, and what does that tell us about ourselves? And in Courage or Cringe, DACA hits a roadblock, Hobby Lobby's First Amendment ad campaign, and Idris Elba wants your ID. Is a federal judge's recent DACA ruling a politically influenced hit job that advances an anti-immigrant agenda? Or is it a principled decision that puts the onus of immigration reform back in the legislative branch where it belongs? Is a Christian-owned and run retailer's ad campaign a beacon of free speech and advertising? Or is it a veiled attack on pluralism and religious freedom for everyone? And finally, is a Hollywood star's recommendation of mandatory ID to bring bad actors to light in social media a masterstroke of genius or another potential attack on consumer privacy from social platforms that already know way too much? This and so much more on this week's episode of TDR. Santa Cecilia. That's what I was thinking about.
Oh, the new record?
The new, I don't know what the name of the album is, but they have a new track. I saw the video on YouTube. It was a really good song. It was actually really cool. I was back on this whole tip of you and I've been
listening
talking
to
about.
Albums.
I'm telling you, there's something there. I think that we have to go back to album listening because you heard my thesis, but you know, I don't, it may be worth repeating here that.
Let's hear it.
I think the idea of albums, which, you know, I think has been replaced largely by the idea of singles and videos and now increasingly even shorter kind of forms of media, right? TikToks, et cetera.
Yep.
But the idea that albums is really cool because something unique is happening on the artist side as is happening on the listener or the viewer side, if you will. And what I mean by that is that when you have an album from an artist perspective is representative of a period of time. Of an era, of an epoch, of, you know, somebody going through something. It's a breakup, it's a new relationship, it's a new stage in life, whatever it may be. And that artist is telling that full story over whatever number of songs it is, 7, right, 12, right. 10, yeah. Whatever. And so there's something unique about each song, but there's also something special about the album. And then I think the same thing happens on the listener side, which is you have somebody listening at a particular, you know, across all these songs, if you're listening to the whole album, and that whole period can be representative for you of an important part that you're going through, right? And it can tell the whole story for you. So I think like it's a unique kind of artist and listener or artist and viewer or artist and patron kind of thing that happens with albums. And I don't know, I don't think we do that much anymore. At least I hadn't, like I hadn't listened to an album beginning to end in,
yeah,
I don't know.
For me, it had been a while, but it just so happened that when you brought the topic, I had literally just gone through that and listened to two of my favorite albums and probably I still think my favorite artist that I've ever had listened to, which is D'Angelo. And I think his first two albums, in my humble opinion, are two of the best albums put together where literally every single song was a hit.
Nice.
Every single song, and it is very representative to your point of a time period, right? Like the first album, which was labeled called Brown Sugar, I think that came out when I was in high school. I'm not sure exactly when in high school that was, because I don't know if I heard it immediately when it came out.
Yeah,
and then I remember his second album, I think it's called Devil's Pie. That one is actually not as clear to me in terms of
Brown
when that
Sugar
happened.
Came out in 1995.
Oh, perfect. So I was graduating from high school.
Yeah.
That makes
it's a good year.
Perfect sense as to why. Yeah, that's right. That's right. My freshman year, that was and it was like a very odd thing because none of my friends listened to that kind of music. They all thought it was really odd that I listened to this very
why?
Soulful.
Well, because it was like R&B?
Yeah, because it was that's not the kind of music that you listen to as a single guy graduating from high school. Like it's, you know, it was a lot of hip hop music people listened to, especially my friends. So they found it very odd that this very soulful kind of music, very complex kind of sound that this guy put together, that's the kind of thing I would be into.
I like that stuff right around that time.
Yeah. Especially at that age, though, you know?
For sure. That was right around the same time like Erykah Badu and all that stuff
yeah,
came
exactly.
out. That was also
yeah, yeah.
very similar kind of vibe,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. So that was all in that sort of time period.
We've already established, though,
he was one of the best.
Yeah, for sure.
He did, by the way, only like three albums, maybe four. I mean, he did not do much music.
He's not doing anything now?
There's a one album I was listening to very recently, and I don't know when that album came out, but to my knowledge, he went away for a long, long time.
Yeah, I'm looking at his Wikipedia right now.
Devil's Pie is the second album that to me is like, once again, some of the best.
But these are albums. This is an album that you think from beginning to end.
It only
shows two. Yeah, it's really weird.
It should be
weird.
Like three albums that he has. There was another one that he did, like live from this cafe in Paris, I think is what he did. But that was not really like an album. It was like repeats of his own songs.
It looks like the highest peak position that he had in the dance charts was Me and Those Dreaming Eyes of Mine, 1996.
Yeah, that's from his first album, yeah.
Position number two. Never got to number one. That's got to be tough, getting there number two. Your discography gets there number two. Yeah. No, but I don't know. I don't know. I was feeling a little bit nostalgic. I was listening to, you know, full albums and, you know, ride my motorcycle and stuff.
Oh, by the way, it's called Voodoo, not Devil's Pie. Devil's Pie is a song within the album called Voodoo.
Oh, okay.
Very good, yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't see the albums here on the Wikipedia. It just shows the singles.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, albums. We need more albums. That's my thesis. So we're on the road today.
Yes.
Remote show from lovely Glendale.
Is where we Nevada? I can't even tell you how far we are from home.
It may as well be Nevada. Glendale from the west side of Los Angeles.
I know, that's a very LA comment, isn't it?
But we're actually in a TV studio, so you know, I think it sounds pretty good. We'll see what happens. See where it goes. But it's nice to be in a different spot. You know what I mean? Slightly larger table. Get a little bit more distance from you so I can take a swing and, you know, get some...
We'll see how this episode goes, right?
Exactly. But very interesting headline for our show. What does it even mean, right? If you win, you're British. If you lose, you're black. And of course, yeah. The real saying is if you win, you're English.
Right.
And if you lose, you're black. But we thought that may not be as clear to understand given the fact that English is also a language. But what does that even mean? Where does that come from?
Well, we wanted to, as part of the deep dive, really talk about the impact that racism has had in the game of soccer, especially when you think about the international game of soccer, right? So part of this came, of course, because over a week ago, so not this past Sunday, but the Sunday before that, we had the Euro 2020 final, where Italy defeated England in penalty kicks, right? So it was a great game, by the way. I watched the end of it.
Yeah.
Watched the second half of the penalty kicks.
At the exact same time that the, is it Copa Oro? Or what is the other, the...
Copa Oro just started, I want to say.
Not Copa Oro, the other one, the...
Copa America.
Copa America,
yeah. That one, Argentina won.
That Argentina won. So my joke was, you know, both the Northern and Southern Hemisphere Italians won.
Exactly. Both of these tournaments. Yeah. And look, also Argentina was interesting, right? Like they've been chasing that for a long
for
time,
sure.
Especially for Messi, right?
Never won one.
Was very happy for him that he finally got one under his belt. So mm-hmm. That's, you know, good for them, I'm sure. You know, his people are very, very happy. But this game was really interesting for a whole set of reasons. It was like for England, it's been a while since they've been able to win a Euro Cup. And they've had a lot of struggles. So the fact that they got there was really impressive. And with a very, very young team.
England's reputation for people who don't follow soccer, at least on a national level, is that they're always going to break your heart. That's
right.
Basically their reputation that they have. They won the World Cup in 60, I think, or 60, 64.
I don't know.
It was only once. They've only won once, the World Cup, which, of course, is the biggest competition. But just as a national squad, they tend to have a reputation of starting really strong, tons of hype. They're going to be amazing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then, just but this
fall.
Time, they made it all the way
to the final with a, you know, once again, a very young team. But the sad thing here is that what's actually gotten the most attention was not the score or the fact that they had this awesome run, but the immediate racist reaction that the three young black players from England, who all three missed their penalty kicks. Now, I think two of them got subbed in, like literally the last minute of the overtime, or last few minutes of overtime, right? But it was the three black players that missed their penalty kicks that received tons of basically hate online. For missing those goals, which is where this sort of this phrase comes from, and was repeated again, which is when you win, you're English, but when you lose, you're black, right?
This game went to when the game is tied. Obviously, if it's still tied at the very end of regulation time,
yeah.
They go to a penalty kickoff, basically.
Yeah, so what they do is they go to overtime, which is two 15-minute
right.
periods, right? So 30 minutes, and then they go to penalty kicks,
right?
And it was in those penalty kicks where. Where they missed, right?
As an aside on penalty kicks, is it my impression or has it just gotten a lot less accurate or easier to get blocked. Like penalty kicks for me used to be almost an automatic. Like there'd be the one guy who missed out of five.
Yeah.
But the keepers have gotten much better. Like
the keeper for Italy, to his credit, that dude was as cool as ice, man. To his credit, he wasn't too hype. He was just like,
and those dudes are stopping very left and right. They're doing really good.
I mean, look, put aside the racism part. I mean, the part of the chance that not very sophisticated opinion about the penalty kicks. It's part of they got a little cute on some of the penalty kicks.
Yeah, well, they have. I mean,
and,
you think
and
about
that's
it, it's like
part of the challenge, because most cases, if you just go up there and just drill one,
yeah, you're not going
to
get
it. It's just
stopped.
Really hard to stop it. It just really is.
But that's the thing, is everybody's trying to fake out the keeper, and the keeper's trying to fake out the striker, and everybody's playing games with each other, and
because
it's been a little too cutesy.
You've all seen the YouTube videos of people just like run up, and then just like pop the ball up, and the keeper just dives to the side, and the ball rolls right in, right?
Fake.
So there's all these different things. But put that all aside, I mean, the reality is that these guys just got destroyed online, right? And for missing, right? And it wasn't just for missing. Like, it's one thing to go after them for missing as soccer players, right? But is that for being, once again, this comment that because they lost, now they're once again reminded that they're black. And it was just another reminder of the racism problem that the European soccer has faced for a long time, right? It did this of course, got immediate condemnation from leaders, including, you know, the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, and even Prince William, right? Now, Johnson said at a news conference, "To those who have been directing racist abuse at some of the players, I say shame on you, and I hope you will crawl back under the rock from which you emerged. The entire team play like heroes." And that, that sentiment, by the way, I would say, at least in the coverage that the media gave to the team, was very much like they play like heroes despite them, you know, losing. But it was, once again, the actual online response, right? So what's interesting here is the players, right? In some part, some of this is also, I think, very reflective of the times, right? Because for some of the players, they've used their fame to actually stake out some of the political positions, right? That have also caused mixed emotion, right?
Can I just set just like a little bit of a backdrop, though? Because this whole idea of the abuse that these guys got for missing the penalty kick reminded me of just how ludicrous the heightened sense of kind of nationalistic pride can become around these competitions.
Yeah, sure.
As a person of Colombian descent, I remember one of the best squads that Colombia ever had was a 1994 national team.
Uh-huh.
That cup was actually here in the U.S., I think, if I recall correctly. But
I already know what you're going to say, but yeah.
But Andrés Escobar, right, who was one of the players, did an own goal.
Right, auto goal.
An auto goal, right? Autogol is how you say it in Spanish, but an own goal in English. And this guy, not only was he, I mean, this is before social media, obviously, but the guy was completely torn apart in the press. His family was threatened, and he was eventually shot and killed.
Right.
By you know, I don't even remember who it was, but I mean, this guy was murdered for having made a mistake on the pitch, because one of the problems with all this stuff is that you get this sense of national pride wrapped up into all of this stuff. And it's like somehow the entire, you know, country has been...
The reputation of the country.
The reputation of the country has been impacted. And then some nut takes it upon himself to like go right this wrong, right, on the scale. And there's some of that in this, I think.
There is definitely some of that in here. I think the other element, though, which I was going to get into, is that there also is this dynamic that has been added to sports around social activism.
Right.
Right. Which is something that definitely comes across, it was happening here with the game, in the fact that, you know, when we had all of the social unrest here in the U.S., you know, it wasn't just a U.S. issue, especially in the response that people had to the death of George Floyd, is that that happened also globally. And even the notion of people kneeling in response to police brutality, in response to, frankly, racism, is sort of like the broader stance. That's something that also translated to European soccer. And it's something that specifically the English team has been doing, right? In an item that there's been some mixed emotions, right? There is, as an example, Boris Johnson's, right, his home secretary, Priti Patel, refuse to condemn people for booing them when the team kneels before games, right? And it's something that they did, again, as part of the final, where even Italian players also joined them in kneeling down, right? So that also adds this extra layer of sort of these issues being sort of weaved in, right? But the reality is, so it's not just really an issue in England, right? That's kind of the part of the problem, right? So in recent years, UEFA, the governing body of European soccer, you know, has worked quite a bit to combat racism against his players, both online and in stadiums. But the behavior has persisted, right? In Italy and in other places, world-class players of color have been subjected to racism chants. They even have bananas thrown on the field, right? A lot of, that's actually the common one, is that it's primarily the black players that get all the abuse. And that's, you know, and unfortunately it happens all the time. Look, even recently, a few days ago, Germany's Olympic soccer team walked off the field during a friendly game they were playing versus Honduras, which was meant to be a warm-up of the Tokyo Olympics, citing racist abuse of one of their players.
Of one of the German players, one of the German Honduran players.
No, right. One of the German players, correct. Right. So they walked off the field. So it is an issue that unfortunately has been just so embedded in
in
soccer in general, European soccer specifically.
This is not, it matters to a degree, I guess, what the answer to this question is. And it's not to excuse, but just to explain or try to make sense of it. How much of this is this, again, kind of more nationalistic thrust of your country beat my country, I hate you, and I'm now trying to find the most, destructive way to explain that animosity to you? Not that it matters. I'm just saying how much of it is that versus I just don't like black people. And I ask that in the context of, you just mentioned the German team.
Right.
A lot of people not necessarily equate the German national team with having black players, but they do.
They do.
They have black players on the team. A lot of them are, you know, obviously immigrants or children of immigrants from Africa and other places, but they do have black players, German players on the team who are black. So again, not that it matters, but I'm asking just as a point of
I think the national games definitely, I think, heighten it even more, right?
Yeah.
But it's not an issue that is in any way limited to national teams, because part of the examples they bring up is what's happened quite a bit in the Italian league, right? Where black players who play in the Italian leagues have been abused specifically with this kind of racism,
sure,
right? So some of these examples talk about throwing bananas at players. That's not, if I recall correctly, those are not international games. Those are clubs. So, I mean, I definitely think that to your point, when you're talking about national teams playing, there is this high, like, sort of ridiculousness that happens, mm-hmm, stupidity that happens, frankly, between, you know, how people feel that the team, what they're doing represents the honor of the entire country. And therefore, any kind of negative reaction becomes so much more, you know, blown up to the example that you gave, mm-hmm, what happened in Colombia. But yeah, it's not limited to that. I mean, that's part of the problem here. What's interesting in looking at this issue is there's, of course, all of the dynamics. And even the thing that I did find already super interesting in thinking about this is that what role has the fact that social activism is now playing a bigger role within sports? Does that creating additional animosity, maybe in a sport that already was dealing with this issue before, because this is not a new thing.
Well, it's
right?
definitely adding a new variable to the whole thing.
It's adding to it, for sure. Because that was part of the reaction. People were saying, like, oh, you guys are now, like, defending the team, but yet you're not willing to stand for the players when they want to call for more racial justice, right? So there is this dynamic that is being sort of pushed there. And I think for some people that already were looking for the excuse, this just gives them more excuse to go and you know, go after them.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing to think about this issue is, of course, at a macro level, this is, you know, a massive social and cultural issue, right? But what about, like, the actual players themselves, right? What impact does this have on their ability to perform as athletes when they are at constant risk of being targeted with racism? Going back to, like, if a mistake is made by a black player, isn't just a football player that made a mistake, it's a black player that made a mistake, right? And that question, what I thought was really interesting, is that I found in a report, right, this analysis that was done this past December, a group of economists from the University of Trento in Italy and the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris, they basically set out to try to answer this question, which is by posing one of the first studies seeking to measure the impact of in-stadium abuse on the game. Which was like
on performance
itself. Like, what is the mental and physical impact that it has on the performance of the players when people are being abused or there is the risk of abuse, right? And how they did this, I thought, was actually really, really smart, right? They looked at the performance of about 500 Series A players, right? They play within the Italian league, right?
Serie A. It's Serie A.
It's Serie A, okay.
Serie A.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. In the first half of the 2019-2020 season, right, of the main Italian Championship League. So this is before the COVID-19 pandemic, when mm-hmm. the stadiums were full. And then compare that to the second half, right, when games were played in empty stadiums, right?
Because you're never going to get that chance again, realistically, right?
It's actually a great, I mean.
Super.
you hate to, like, you know, see the silver lining in a pandemic, but it actually, in this specific case, it allowed for that kind of dynamic, right? Mm-hmm. Now, according to their study, there was only one group of sub players, right, who played noticeably better in the absence of crowds, right? Now, in regards to the results, the people from the study, they said, and I quote, "We find that players from Africa who are most commonly targeted by racial harassment experience a significant improvement in performance when supporters are no longer at the stadiums."
Right? Any supporters, though, not just the racist ones, all of them.
All of them. Well, yeah, because the reality is they're equating to having supporters. It's really hard to separate those that are racist versus those that are not.
This is really,
I think, is the dynamic, the fact that when supporters are there, the right. likelihood of having a chance of someone, you know, having a racist reaction against them is just higher, right? Right. And there's a thing kind of hanging over your head, right? So two additional points, right? They said that players of African origin play worse in front of spectators, but nobody else performed better.
Okay, so hang on a second. Do you say that again?
So players of African origin play worse in front of spectators.
Yes.
But nobody else performed better.
So the non-black players did not improve in stadiums with no fans.
Right.
But the black players did.
But the black players got worse, right?
They got the opposite, right? So the black players got worse.
Right. But the non-black players didn't play better or worse in either scenario. Think of it that way.
But wait a minute. No. The black players didn't play worse in the non. They played worse in the stadiums that have people, not in the ones without people.
Right. It was only those African origin players who played worse when there was people. Right.
Worse when there was people. Right. That's what I mean.
But the non-black players did not play better. Meaning that their performance was about the same
net
with
neutral.
Or without crowds.
So net neutral with or without. So black players,
essence,
net positive without.
Black player, net positive, correct. Or better way, net negative with, right?
Net negative with.
Net negative with fans, which means that it only made the overall performance worse when fans were available, right?
Of
because
course, all, a team
there
game.
Was only one portion of the players that got worse.
Yeah.
No one got better.
How did they jump? What are the metrics of?
They looked at everything, right? Like their passing accuracy, shots.
Accuracy,
I mean, you actually have a lot of data. They looked at what I was, and
that's
I didn't include any of this
in
here. They looked at a lot of metrics that you will look at like fantasy sports. Right?
Yeah.
Which that makes complete sense to me. Like, yeah, if you can do that, perfect, right? Just see, like, you can measure all the performance that you typically do. Like, do you see any variance there, right? And it was even more interesting. Here's the one that blew me away. In those players that had already been subject to racial incidents or played for teams that have been subject to racial incidents, right? Their performance was 3 times higher than the average of the African descent players.
Who had not been exposed to it.
Right, right. So think about that. When there was no fans around. So they got significantly better.
Okay, so hang on. So
let me give you the actual numbers, okay? Let's make it easier.
Okay, go ahead. Because
African origin players performed 3% better. It's only 3%, right? 3% better when there was no fans.
Got
on
it.
Average, right?
Okay.
Then when you looked at the teams.
Black players.
The teams and that had black players who had historically some racial incidents.
Yes.
Right? Those black players that were African descent perform 10% better when there was no fans around. So basically were through over 3x better than the average increase of those African descent players.
Okay, so this is super interesting.
How crazy is that?
Super crazy, especially when you consider that the overall quality of the game is impacted by this, obviously. It's not just what's happening with them individually. But here's the interesting thing about this, because I had scanned the notes on this earlier. And I thought, I thought it was super interesting, but I thought my commentary was going to be, well, hang on a second, Jesus. You can't attribute the delta entirely to racism, okay? And clearly, you still can't in a way.
Right, you still can't. Yeah.
But it's
high correlation.
No, but super high correlation, especially because they have the second group.
The second group, which is the one
who's already been experiencing, exposed to this, and how they overperformed even the overperforming group.
Right.
The point that I was going to bring up is this, and I think it solves for at least maybe the first 3% of that variance, not the 10, but the 3.
Yeah.
And that is the fact that almost 100%, I mean, they even call them African players because—
African descent players.
So African descent players because, when we think of black people, we think, from an American context, we think of a variety of people, American, black, black from, you know, from the African continent, black from other parts of the world. But from a soccer context, especially Italian soccer, which is what this is, 100% of the players are of African descent. The reality of it is we don't really export very many American players to these international leagues, less of
Oh, sure.
Of the American players we export, like I don't even know of like what the African American players are. So it's a very, very small minority. And then you start thinking.
But also know how many like African Italian players are playing in the Italian league.
Meaning, there's a number. There's definitely a number.
So even the African descent one, right, part of it, you can like, make the argument, which is, well, yeah, but how many generations removed they are from Africa, right?
Yeah, true.
I don't know. They didn't actually speak to that.
Well, yeah.
And there may be some big difference there, maybe for those that are more recent immigrants.
And I think there is, because that's kind of where I was going to go. And again, I'd like to look at the data a little bit more closely, because you have players, I mean, famous Italian black player, like Mario Balotelli as an example, who is like Italian through and through, right? I mean, of course, he's descent from... from African, family, but he himself is Italian. Where you have other people who are more recent, immigrants, especially playing on international clubs, where you don't have to be a citizen of the country, right? If you're representing the national team in the World Cup, the idea is that you are from that country, either by naturalization or because you were born there. Not the case in international competitions at the club level. But my point that I was going to make, this is a long-winded way of saying this. The point I was going to make is that a lot of the African players who are now playing in Europe, especially in Italy, come from West Africa, right? No offense to East or South or North, but the players are in West Africa. Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, Nigeria. That's who have like the really great players.
Those also have better national teams too.
Right? Better
national
teams.
So they probably have better soccer infrastructure altogether.
Correct.
Yeah, something like Kenya, for example, like never hear of them in the World Cup.
Exactly. And only because I've...
Great runners, though.
Great runners. And same thing with the Ethiopians. So East Africa is known for running, West Africa for soccer. Anyway, my point is that only because I've been there, I can tell you that there's not a lot of stadium play. There's not a lot of crowds watching you play, right? And so this idea, because I was thinking, well, what percentage of this is just the fact that being in this environment...
Like in the bright lights, you think?
Well, I'm just saying, given the backdrop of West African soccer... I think you answered it. I think you answered it, which is it's at least correlated to the first delta, which is a 3%.
Maybe, yeah.
Some portion of it, to my mind, has to be in that third delta.
I have a little harder time with that argument you're making, Charlie, is because when you think about these players that play for these kind of international teams, they get recruited so young that they're in those bright lights for a long time. Like these are, for the most part, like these guys that get put into systems like as kids many times.
Yeah,
right? they get identified really, really early. So
yeah, they do.
So this notion of not being as much in the bright lights, but you think about the guys that make it to that level are people that are tend to be identified pretty early on. So there could be some of that of people feeling uncomfortable with the bright lights because you're talking about the biggest sport in the world,
right?
And in the biggest stages of the world, which is what we're talking about here. But you're right. That second group is where there's such a big jump.
Yeah,
that it's just hard to say.
Put
that
it this way,
there isn't a tight correlation there.
Correlation there. I'd love to see another group go through this who comes from maybe predominantly very rural and poor countries that have a similar makeup to West African players. Again, I think that the second group the second stat, which is the 10%, says exactly like that delta to me is 100% racism, from the 7 to the 10. Or from the
4 to the 10, I guess.
From the 4 to the 10.
Yeah, from the 3 to the 10. Yeah,
from the 3 to the 10, that 7% is 100% racism.
Yeah.
Of the 3, either all of it or there's got to be some portion of it
I'm sure there's
just a kind of the bright
lights. It will be interesting to think about other players that come from other parts of the world to see whether they have similar kind of dynamic, right, to your point.
But specifically poorer, more rural areas that don't have the kind of, like, if you're coming up in another European country, if you're coming up in the States, you know, you're used to this idea of fandom and stadiums and whatever. If you're coming up in maybe Honduras, right? Guatemala.
Right, sure.
You know, Nigeria, Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, places like that where you're playing oftentimes barefoot. You're playing, you know, oftentimes not even with a ball. You're like you're growing up in a village. You're using rags and wrapping them together to make a ball to play. And then suddenly you get scooped up, yes, at 13, 14, but then you get shipped to a stadium. And 2 years later, you're playing at San Siro in Milan with 95,000 people.
It's a bunch of really interesting stats. Well, wait, one thing
I'm not a statistician or a researcher.
This analysis is not peer reviewed yet. Okay, so it is. They're going through that process now.
Now you tell me.
So, it's definitely worth mentioning.
No, it's super interesting. Yeah,
but they're going through it. But I think it was so interesting the stats and the lens that they're using to look at racism, because we talk about it so much from a social cultural kind of lens, which is important. But when you think about the type of stress that these players must be under, knowing that their every move, and we know from a practical standpoint, unfortunately, many times when you are a minority, it's like you, whether you like it or not, you are representing many times your entire ethnic group,
sure,
whether that's your intent or not, right? And yep. I think we've seen some version of that. So you have to imagine there is obviously some kind of impact here. And even if once it gets reviewed, it gets adjusted some, I just thought that the lens that they were using at looking at the impact that racism has on sports. I mean, if you're an Italian league team and you're under this group where some of your players are doing 10% worse.
Yeah, it's
because
crazy.
Of the environment that you have in your stadium. Like, I will be extremely concerned.
I'd be, exactly. But I mean, it's
extremely
like,
concerned.
And then, like, how do you solve for that? How do you solve for either assuming the first 3% is just bright lights, big city, and then 7% is full on racism? How do you optimize for that?
I think the way you solve for it is look,
give everybody ear pods.
Let's not go so far away. Let's talk about what's happening with the Mexico national team.
Sure.
Right? They've struggled for years with trying to control the crowds to now have, basically, not have a very traditional anti-LGBTQ chant that they always do, right, in games. And what they started to crack down is like, look, you keep on doing that, we're not going to let you in the games anymore. And you saw it's taken a long time, but recently it seemed like it's starting to turn around. And it's that threat of saying, hey, you continue doing this, you're not going to be in the games. And there is, look, in terms of fan bases that travel really well, support their national team. Mexico's at the very top of the list. If they're not, they may not be number one or no, but they're top five.
They're up there.
They're
for
really
sure.
up
the
there.
The national team just played Nigeria here like 2-3 weeks ago in downtown LA. It was crazy because I was down in downtown and just seeing all the fans.
Yeah, no, they are very hardcore, but that's a real threat, and people will take that very, very serious. So maybe that is what needs to happen.
Yeah.
Is start throwing people long enough, say, hey, anyone throws a banana here, we're like the next two games, no one shows up at the stadium. So now you kind of have to police each other. You see anyone that's even thinking about it, and people will care. I think that's the way you start changing it.
Yeah, that one. I mean, there's stuff like that that's super overt, and then there's stuff that is, you know, the insult is in the eye of the beholder, and these are contentious environments. I just worry about something like like somebody's going to say,
out there. You know,
I get it, but it's hard. Just
let's control those. How about that? Control those that are way out there.
Yeah,
and then we could talk about the more subtle ones later.
And it does impact safety too, right? I mean, if you're throwing crap on the field and you're trying to, you may incite violence by doing that. So there's a lot of like real safety issues and concerns. Here's my last word on this. On my side. It's really, I think, subhuman or, you know, inhuman. I don't like using inhumane because that's something you apply not to people but to animals or other things. But it's not really valuing the dignity of people to do any of this kind of stuff, particularly when you think about what actually has happened, okay? Missing a penalty kick in a national competition with a championship on the line is among the most memorable in a negative way things that any athlete can do, period.
Sure.
The thought that you have, and you see this in the expression of these young people when they take the shot and they
course,
miss, man, it is soul-crushing devastation.
Yeah.
So if you think you're going to add to that, right, by throwing something on the field or calling someone a name, first of all, it's wrong to do. You're a jackass because you're not, there is no more punishment you can inflict on this person,
right,
if that's what you intend to do. So it's A, the wrong thing to do, and B, it's like a total fool's errand because you're not even achieving your end. And it's like, it's a total misunderstanding of how the game is played and what it actually means. These guys are, they're going to be punishing themselves. I mean, hopefully not for a long time, but the reality is it's tough.
Right.
On yourself. You take it really, really personally. And so I think it's terrible all the way around. And I really feel for these guys for missing to begin with.
I mean, I also think from a strategy as a coach, like bringing in a player who hasn't played a game for almost 120 minutes, having to come in the last couple of minutes of a game and then have to kick a penalty kick. There's something to say like, hey, you got to let people to also adjust to the moment.
Yeah,
like
but you can't, but you can't, like, there but is you a can't piece sub here. In for penalty kicks. You have to put the players
right.
who are on.
Yeah. I know. That's what I'm saying. But
oh, you're
maybe
saying,
part of it, like, bring them a little earlier. Let them adjust it to the moment.
Or if you think you're on your way to a time, maybe don't make the sub with 2 minutes left, right? You just let it play out.
Yeah, but they brought them in purposely, too, so they could be in
they could be in that as a striker.
Yeah, because they were strikers for the... I don't know. I mean, but it's just, you're right. It just adds to it. But anyways, that data, look, we'll keep an eye out to when it gets, you know, hopefully confirmed or whatever it ends up being. But I thought it was a really interesting take on obviously a big global issue that we're dealing with, but from the perspective of performance.
Agreed. The beautiful game. All right. Well, now we move on to the beautiful courage or cringe.
Courage or cringe.
We've got quite the assortment.
Yeah.
DACA, Hobby Lobby, and Idris Elba. What do they have in common? Not much. So we'll see. They have in common that they're on this show. All right. Yeah.
So first, courage or cringe. Judge rules that DACA is unlawful and suspends applications, right? So as reported by the New York Times, this past week, federal judge Andrew Hannon of the U.S. District Court in Houston said President Barack Obama exceeded his authority when he created the DACA program, which was a deferred action for childhood arrivals, by executing the order in 2012. Therefore, ruled that the program was unlawful. Right, this is a program that's now almost 20 years old, right? DACA is a policy that allowed for children who were brought here illegally to stay in the country, go to school, and secure work authorization. Now, since its inception, DACA has enabled more than 800,000 immigrants to remain in this country and secure this work authorization, right? Now, in the ruling, Judge Hannon said that current program recipients will not be immediately affected. Basically, for now, only affected new applicants, right?
So if you're already in the system, you're grandfathered in.
That the federal government should not take any immigration, deportation, or criminal actions against them that it would not otherwise take.
Okay.
Right?
And so this doesn't create anything new for people that are in that situation?
Correct.
Okay.
Right? And then he also ruled that the creation of the program violated the Administrative Procedure Act, in part because comment from the general public was never sought. Right?
Okay.
This goes back to where he thinks that Obama basically exceeded his power, right, within his executive order. In his comments, he said, DHS, or Department of Homeland Security, failed to engage in the statutorily mandated process. So DACA never gained status as a legally binding policy that could impose duties or obligations. The executive branch cannot just enact its own legislative policy when it disagrees with Congress' choice to reject proposed legislation.
Right.
Congress has not given DHS the power to enact DACA, right?
Okay.
So based on this ruling, the Department of Homeland Security may continue to accept new applications, but is temporarily prohibited from approving them, right? Immigrants currently enrolled in the program, most of whom were brought to the United States as children, will for now retain the ability to stay and work in the country. Though those protections, you know, could basically go away if the government is unable to rectify a series of legal shortcomings.
Is this an old suit? Do you know who brought this suit? Like what?
It's been kind of working its way up, my understanding, because there's been multiple suits related to this, right? So as a reminder of this, back in 2017, President Trump tried to cancel the program altogether, right? Now, that issue went up through federal courts, and it ended up ultimately in the Supreme Court in 2020, where the court ruled against them, deeming that his decision to basically get rid of it was both arbitrary and capricious, and therefore it didn't allow him to be able to get rid of the program. However, the court did not rule on whether the program had been legally adopted.
Right. They were just ruling on the case of what he brought to that.
Said that his reason for getting rid of it was not a good enough reason to get rid of it.
But they didn't rule on whether or not it should have been a thing to begin with.
Which is, and that has to be one of the things, I mean, if there's a point of frustration here.
The narrowness
here
of these lawsuits, we talked about it before.
If there's a frustration of this thing, then it doesn't make any sense to me. Well, I'll wait till I jump into this thing. But this is part of my frustration with these kind of cases, right? Now, in this case, there is actual broad support for allowing Dreamers, which is another term that was used for people that were under the DACA program, to stay in the country, right? According to a Pew study, about 3/4 of respondents, including majorities of Democrats and Republicans, favored extending them a pathway to permanent legal status, right? These are people that are already within the program, right?
I think if you understand what who most DACA kids are, it's just it's so logical to be supportive because they've been here their whole lives.
They've been their whole life. They themselves, as children, did not have anything to do with whether they haven't even coming to the country, right?
Yeah.
To your point, these are kids that grew up here. Many cases, kids that have gone to school, are working, people that are contributing to society and that because of no choice of their own are in a situation where they are illegal to still in the country, right? And it hasn't been rectified.
I've met two DACA kids in the last 2 weeks. So really? One of them was a DACA kid before DACA, so I guess you couldn't call him a DACA kid. He's not a kid anymore. The other one is a DACA kid. One of them is my friend Isaac, who came over with his mom when he was 2, and they overstayed their visa before the program, but he stayed for years.
Right.
And then, you know, now, ironically, he actually runs the immigration policy for the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, like one of the biggest dioceses in the country. And then the other person was the son, is the son of one of the families that our nonprofit helps. And he came over at three, was brought over as well as three, undocumented, whole nine yards, but has no recollection of Honduras, which is where he's from.
Yeah.
No, like, he's like Long Beach, like, you know,
that's of course. Yeah.
That's where I'm from, right? So it's a different category. It like, I'm not surprised category, by the support, but anyway, go ahead.
Now, President Biden, on his first day in office, remember that he signed a bunch of executive orders. One of this included a move to strengthen DACA and create a path to citizenship, mm-hmm. right? Which had received some bipartisan support. Now, he's also looking to build support in Congress for this more ambitious plan to allow for up to 10 million other immigrants to live in the country legally. Now, the reality, though, in the case of DACA, it was initially meant to be a temporary measure, right, which President Obama was doing, so Congress could pass more comprehensive legislation, which they haven't been able to do for over in almost now over two decades, right? And that's kind of where we are with this thing, right? So if you think about courage or cringe here, right, the way that I frame this here is this a politically influenced ruling pushing an anti-immigrant agenda or principle ruling, putting the immigration onus back in the legislative branch where it belongs?
Yeah, I think, look, this was one of those ones that you have to separate what actually is happening from a more complex issue. But based on the framing of this, I have to go courage. I think it is a principle ruling that says, look, I'd like to, however I feel about this, this is not the place to actually settle this. You need to actually create a law or amend a law or properly approve a law in order so that it be the law and not try to settle this in the court. So, and that's the frustration that I have with some of this stuff is how narrowly some of these cases are adjudicated. And I understand why, I guess, but like even the thing you said with the Supreme Court, why can't they address it at that point, right? It's like, oh no, Trump is wrong for doing this. Yeah, but we're not going to touch the biggest issue, which is whether or not this thing is actually illegal or a law. We'll let somebody else kind of deal with that. At least that's how I feel.
Right.
So I think in this particular case, this judge saying, look, like you just can't enact legislation from an executive standpoint. It doesn't work for any party. This has never been settled. We've been kicking the can for 20 years. So I'm going to tell you that it's not. You can hate me, but go get it.
It's like a forcing mechanism.
Right, like a forcing mechanism. Go create the legislation, and then we don't have to settle this in a court of law. Now, having said that, and especially because, like I said, I just had contact with DACA kids twice in the last 2 weeks, you know, I can tell you that I fall into the camp of people who's supportive of the path right. to citizenship and, you know, and all the 800,000 or more people who are here that are either DACA or DACA-like, like my friend. So for sure, it's not about that. It's kind of like separating these two things. But I think it is principled to the point of being legalistic. Like it's actually like super by the book, right? So if we frame it that way, I think it has to be courage, even if I may not agree with what the outcome is right now.
Yeah. I've gone back and forth on this one. I mean, the part that really makes me angry in about this issue is the fact that you've had these poor kids who are now adults sitting in this sort of mode of limbo, right, for now almost 20 years. And all because we cannot, they've grown up in limbo. It's because as a country, we cannot get our act together and put together an actual policy that we can agree on that addresses this one way or another, right? And even these kids that constantly extending, worry about, because you have to extend, you have to renew every 2 years, I want to say, for DACA, right? So you're in this constant state of not knowing, is this the year that I'm not going to get renewed? Am I going to get kicked out now? You know, you have this battle between presidents with executive orders and Congress who refuses to get on the same page on anything and basically take any kind of action. It also really bothers me that the Supreme Court will take this kind of ruling and say, and I find you say like it's not a good enough reason. Great. But also you can't ignore that if it is case, because look, frankly, I don't know if it is by the book or not that an executive order by the president couldn't handle this. But it doesn't look good if the Supreme Court looks at an issue and it ignores that fact altogether and only focuses on the reason why another president is looking to cancel it. Like that doesn't make any sense to me how you would ignore that, at least have some put some kind of opinion against that. Because by not opining on it, you my orientation would be is that no, then you say it is a legal thing that he actually did. Then I think in that case, then the federal judge is wrong in his interpretation. At least you're implying that by saying this. And I think that's the part where when you look at some of the comments back that's what people are saying. Like, we think it's going to get overturned
because
of this opinion. But the fact that it wasn't more directly responded to and say, hey, first, we think it's legal what Obama did. And then B, you can't just get rid of it because you just changed your mind. Like, that's not a good enough reason. And if you did that, then like, fine, I respect that. Like, but, that's better.
Isn't this part of a bigger problem, though, that this kind of, this whole idea is rests on this notion of what you believe the courts should or shouldn't be, like strict constructionist or more interpretive? Because, you know, the typical conservative viewpoint, right of center, would be no, judges should be strict or stricter constructionists.
Right. Right.
They should read the law, they should interpret the law, they shouldn't make new law. The left side of the fence, and, you know, by varying degrees, but would say no, let's not miss this opportunity, like what you just said, right? And in this case, I'm equally frustrated, right, that we just kind of so narrowly did it. But doesn't it rest on that kind of philosophical interpretation probably, of what a judge should or shouldn't do?
It probably does, Charlie. That's what I'm guessing. But I think it's a cop-out in this specific case only because the legality of the law is a I can't think of the right word. It's an important element of deciding whether or not the reason someone wants to get canceled the law is a good enough reason. Right, because it could say, hey, by the way, it's a moot point because the law you're trying to cancel, it was never legal to begin with. So to me, not answering that first point, just think about that, right? It's like you're trying to enforce a contract and someone says, hey, I want to get out of this contract. You're like, okay, what's your reason? Because I think it's bad terms. And when I look at the contract, well, this contract's not enforceable. So therefore, the whole thing just goes away.
The terms
but if
matter.
I don't agree, if I don't look at the fact whether the contract is enforceable or not, and all I look at is whether or not your reasons for wanting to get out of the contract are true or not, knowing that there is like this big hanging gray area of the enforceability of the contract. And that, to me, that's
a
problem.
Good point.
Right?
Yeah.
So you're not creating new law. You're simply, it's a very important element associated with that law that you either have
and
to address
is,
or not.
There is versions of that.
So I have no idea
that,
why they wouldn't address that, you know?
There are versions of that or situations like that in the law, like for instance, the idea of not having standing to bring a suit to begin with.
Sure.
So there are people who say,
I
won't even consider the merits of the case because you shouldn't even be in front of me. Like,
right.
So there is some of that.
Yeah, there
that
is some
happens.
Of that. But I think in this case, right, do you have standing? That makes sense. But if something is, which is basically what this judge is saying, is like, this shouldn't even ever even begin to, you know, he never had the power to put this in place anyway. So this shouldn't even ever be the case. I think that is a very important part of the equation in considering whether the reason that President Trump was bringing this law, trying to get rid of it, whether that reason was good enough or not. So funny enough, in this one, I'm actually courage, and I hate to say that I'm courage, but I think in this case, this is one of the few times where I would agree that this may actually be a forcing mechanism to look at it, right? To actually have to make a real change. But I really hope, man, that they do something about solving this for these poor people that have been in this constant limbo state for almost 20 years. And I think it's ridiculous. And for people that to the thing we're discussing, they were not like they didn't you know, more likely buy their own tickets to get here or whatever. Like, these are kids that were brought here as children. And I think we deserve, you know, to do better by them and actually take care of them and making sure that they can have a little bit more stability in their role in this country, be able to contribute the way they have been for the last 20 years.
Okay.
It's a little bit of rant.
No, leave that word. Even if I don't mind if you rant as long as we end up on the same place in this one. So I'm happy. I'm happy with the rant. One for one.
So changing tunes here. So courage or cringe? Hobby Lobby faces backlash over newspaper ad calling for Christian-run government.
By the way, who goes to Hobby Lobby and Michaels? It's the same person. Like, it's, you're looking for a craft. You're looking for like a model car.
Number of times.
You're looking for like,
or you have kids, because a lot of things with kids. That's the reason why I've gone to Hobby Lobby a number of times, because there's a bunch of stuff that for school, for you're doing activities, etc. We do like a lot of art stuff there. They have we like to do painting, so we get the canvases there, right? So it's a bunch of stuff like that.
But it's pretty much the same demo, right? I mean, for both places.
Yeah, it is. So, as reported by Newsweek, right, Hobby Lobby, who is this arts and crafts store, you know, got itself into some controversy over the 4th of July weekend after it ran a full-page advertisement where it seemed to call for a Christian-run government.
See, I know this whole story is already BS because somebody getting into trouble for running an ad in print can't be real because nobody
exactly.
Who's going to
who
see
read
it? Who's going to see it?
Now, the advert, which ran nationally, was titled One Nation Under God. And included the Bible verse, "Bless the nation whose God is the Lord." as the company also posted about its campaigns on its social media pages, right? Now, so basically the advert had a bunch of quotes, all of which highlighted the importance of God and government, like mix of God and government kind of thing, by a number of people, including some of those being founding fathers, right? Now, there was a quote from John Adams that read, "We have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. Our Constitution was made only for religious and moral people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other," right? Now, even with some of those quotes, right, according to FFRF, a nonprofit, I don't forget what it stands for, a nonprofit organization that advocates for atheists, agnostics, and non-theists.
There's an organization for everybody at this point.
What would be considered a non-theist? People just don't believe in anything?
Well,
that's not an atheist.
An atheist is somebody who makes a positive claim, right? So God does not exist. An agnostic says, I've seen no evidence for the existence of God. A non-theist could be somebody who is Hindu, who has maybe as a pantheist, who believes in many, many gods. Oh. It could be somebody who is Mormon, you know, or Jehovah's Witness, who don't believe in one God, but in like a variety of gods. Actually,
I didn't know what that meant.
The Church of Latter-day Saints, like which they don't call themselves Mormon anymore, so I don't mean any disrespect, but it used to be called Mormons.
I didn't know that.
The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They are technically, the word is henoists, I think, which is that they believe that there is a number of gods, but there's one big god.
Okay.
And then there's pantheism, which is, henotheist, I think is what it's called. Then there's pantheist, which is like, you know, like a traditional Hindu faith would have. There's gods for, you know, everything. And that's, you know, kind of going back even Native American religiosity, where there's God of the sun, God of the moon, that kind of thing. Henotheist. Yes, henotheism. I was right.
Got it. All right, that was a side tangent, but that's great. So these are this organization, right? So they said that Hobby Lobby was making it seem like these statements came one after another. So kind of taking away the context that the former president used, but that he used basically religious and moral as synonyms in the full speech, right? So basically saying, look, you're taking sort of snippets of different speeches and making it sound like it was one thing. But it was did you actually look at the advert?
I didn't, no.
Yeah, so I did. So it was just a number of different quotes. Like all like one next to each other, right? Different people, right? Now, the company has been placing similar advertisements on U.S. holidays since Hobby Lobby founder David Green felt commissioned, and I put that in quotes, something that he actually said, by God to make them in 1995, right? Mm-hmm. So he felt that he was called by God to do this. Mm-hmm. Now, the company actually said, and I quote, "Before long, Hobby Lobby was placing beautiful full-page ads celebrating the real meaning of Christmas, Easter, and Independence Day in newspapers across the country. The impact and relevancy of these messages is ongoing." Now, of course, people took issue with this on social media, especially those from other religious views or beliefs, as being an attack on freedom of religion and the right of religious minorities, right? Now, in July 2020, Hobby Lobby faced calls for boycotts after a photo of a display in one of its stores reading USA Vote Trump, and decorative letters was shared on Twitter, right? So, courage or cringe, freedom of speech or private industry attacking religious freedom?
I went to that article that showed the letters organized on a display case.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know how many times I've walked into a store and seen customers have rearranged stuff to make it look like something? I doubt highly that anybody put up a Trump thing inside one of these stores. In that particular example. Do you want me to go first?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess I'm not really sure what the backlash is for. Is it for the fact that there's this maybe inaccuracy in the quotes, or there's a lack of context given in the quotes, or is it the fact that they're linking Christmas and 4th of July and Independence Day with a kind of Christian worldview? Like, what's the objection?
I think the objection, because maybe there is some other controversy around Christmas and everything that people have, right? But the objection specifically is that they're creating a very, very strong link in the role that God plays in this nation tied to 4th of July. And in their mind, using the quotes as a way to reinforce how strong of a link there should be between Christianity and God and having a government here in the United States, right? So I think that's the part where some of the quotes that you saw in tweets, of course, were people that were Jewish and other kind of religious people that were saying, hey, like, you're basically, by saying that, you're excluding everyone else that falls under religious minority by making these kind of statements. And as a matter of fact, there was even like a tweet of someone who was, I don't know, of a pastor or something, who said, like, this is the kind of thing that...
I saw that one too.
Like, I served as a pastor for over 2 decades, organization like Hobby Lobby are why so many people believe all Christians are hateful and intolerant bigots. The rest of us apologize for them. So this is not someone that's Christian saying
this, and maybe
right?
that's the part I'm missing, is like maybe they did or said something else, because in looking at the quotes that you read, blessed uh-huh. is, I mean, the quote from scripture, blessed is a nation whose God is the Lord, one nation under God.
Right.
These are fairly pedestrian, phrases that, you know, not too long ago would have been regarded as just like everyday stuff in a country that was founded by people who had a Judeo-Christian kind of background, right? So I don't see a lot of controversy in that. Maybe their conflation of some of these quotes, if that's what they're being accused of doing. But even the quotes you shared, right? So like, we have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. So what they're basically saying is like, there's no government we could build that could deal with a population that's whose passions are not grounded in some type of morality, right?
But the point here of contention would be specifically around a Christian-based view of morality. Right. And to the extent that they want to double down as that being the only way to think about this company.
Yeah, look, some of this is again, separating out how the company how the country was founded from what that founding provides a environment for. The country was founded by people who were theists. I mean, they may not have been evangelical Christians, but they believed in God, and they were, exercising, call it Judeo-Christian values and principles in the things that they laid out. Now, can that lay an environment for the flourishing of people who aren't that? I believe it can. So, but then the question could be, in talking about the historicity of something, does that make someone feel bad because they don't participate in that group? Sure. Yeah, I guess it can, right? Mm. And then who is the speaker? In this case, it's a company that sells, model, cars and popsicle stick crafts.
Sure.
And like, again, I don't...
Sells arts and crafts.
Exactly. Sells arts and crafts. I kind of put it in the Chick-fil-A category. So I don't see the controversy. I guess they're facing a backlash over this. I don't also see the whole idea of this sort of, whatever it's called, like aggravating for a Christian-run government. I see more quotes about you really can't have a kind of joyful population that is not somehow, in this context of a government that's been created with something transcendent in mind. I mean, that's kind of how I read it, but that's because I am a Christian.
Yeah, so I think your orientation is one that probably wouldn't bother you too much. Look, by the way, just to give you the categories, I just pulled it up.
Yeah.
So they had categories of quotes under presidents.
Okay.
Quotes under Supreme Court justices. Mm-hmm. So I'll read you one really quickly. Yeah. Right? So the Bible, one of the Supreme Court justices quotes, "The Bible is the best of all books, for it is the word of God and teaches us the way to be happy in the world and the next. Continue, therefore, to read it and regulate your life by its precepts," right? This is from John Jay, the first Chief Justice, right? And then there's like a bunch of other ones like that, right?
Famous John Jay College.
And then there is Founding Fathers.
Sure.
There is Supreme Court rulings. There is Congress. There's education. And then Foreign Opinion. So in all these categories, what they did is they brought in quotes that sort of tie in basically Christian faith specifically around these areas, or individuals that are from those groups, sort of raising the importance of Christian faith as sort of the organizing principles of how we think about this country.
And I totally get that, but I mean, you're basically just pointing out history, right? Now, you can be offended by that, or in the context of, arts and crafts, you don't think that has any place. I get it, and that's your right to be offended, but I give it a cringe if about the backlash, because I just don't see, again, if this was, Governor Newsom sending me an email going, "The Bible's a great book and you should read it cover to cover," I could totally understand it. But
Right.
Or even Facebook, to our earlier point, a different kind of company, but Hobby Lobby, I just don't, it doesn't rise to, I'm a cringe.
You're a cringe.
Cringe on the backlash. Because that is what we're doing, right?
Cringe on the backlash. Correct. Mm-hmm. And the backlash to their face. Look, for me, I'll start with where I'm at. I'm also cringe on the backlash. I think it is their right to say whatever they want to say, and to put out this position of highlighting the Christian, to your point, the Christian tie-ins that we've had over time and has been highlighted by individuals in these different areas of their beliefs that the role that God and Christianity plays within this government, right? I also will be supportive of any other company that had the complete opposite perspective, that say Christianity or any concept of God should play zero role in any form of government that we have in this country. As a matter of fact, if they went all out and said, like, why do we even use a Bible when president gets sworn in? Mm-hmm. What if that president is not even Christian? Like, why does that matter? They should take that out. It should be the Constitution. That's what they should put their hand over. Whatever, right? Like, I will be okay with that kind of position with them as well. Like, I just think in this kind of case, I do see it as freedom of speech. I don't think they're inciting violence. I don't see any negative that is coming out. They have a very specific opinion. I feel the exact same way of something like, you know, we've talked about Chick-fil-A. Like, hey, your owner is a, you know, private company. You feel very strongly about your beliefs. That's great. You make it part of what your company is. Now, if you get any kind of backlash from your consumers from that, and people don't want to buy things there anymore, then that's on you. Like, you've opened up that Pandora box.
Your bed.
But that's not really, and I don't think for them, frankly, it's going to happen. I think people are kind of okay with it. And I see if people that are, of course, they get offended by it, and that's fine. They also have a right to be offended by it. But I personally don't have much of an issue with it because I see it strictly in the category of freedom of press or freedom of speech.
Two for two.
Two for two. I'm not doing well. I'm not proud of myself today. So the third topic in our little final one on courage or cringe. Idris Elba said,
I say that with confidence, like I know, like I've talked to the guy, like he's
my buddy. Oh boy.
He doesn't like to be called Idris. Yeah, it's Idris.
Idris Elba said it should be mandatory for social media users to provide ID to prevent racist abuse.
Yeah, man.
So as reported by BuzzFeed News, right? Actor Idris Elba.
Now you know it's accurate.
Yeah, exactly. You may know him from the new film, Suicide Squad, right? And back in the day, he had a pretty good role in The Office.
Charles Minor was his name.
That's right.
Charles Minor.
He also, you know, for a while, he was. It was rumored that he may be the next James Bond.
Which I still think would have been great.
And that, you know, got his own racist response to that.
And now he's too old. Actually, no. How old is he?
Probably late 40s.
He's not too old for James Bond.
Maybe early 50s, yeah.
Well, maybe, I don't know.
He's probably the same age as the current actor. Or in the same, around the same.
Daniel Craig?
Yeah.
I think Daniel Craig's older than that, actually.
Yeah, maybe, right?
Yeah.
Although Daniel Craig's been doing that role now for 10 plus years, true. I would say, right?
True. Yeah, he was born, Daniel Craig was born in 19, he's 53.
Yeah, they're about the same age, I have to say.
You think he's in his 50s?
Yeah, probably in the same category, same range.
Idris Elba was born in 1972. He's 48.
Oh, 48. Okay, a little bit younger. Yeah,
so he could totally be Bond.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
So he's calling for more stringent ID verification measures on social media platforms in an attempt to combat racism online, right? Now, this is actually in response to our first story that we talked about, the incident, right, related to the Black England players that were being racially abused online, right? Now, Idris, he's calling for social platforms to use these mandatory ID verification for everyone who creates a social media account. Now, to this, he said, people in the public eye get verified on social media. That's, if you guys recall, the little check mark that people have, right? So you have to, like, verify yourself. The process of verification requires them to provide their identity so everyone knows who is speaking. If cowards are being supported by a vial of privacy and secrecy, then social media is not a safe place. If cowards want to spout racial rhetoric, then say it with your name, not your username. So pretty straightforward thought here that he has. So not a new idea, but definitely an interesting one to discuss. And of course, in the age of social media rage and also all these issues with privacy. But listen, this will be a short one for us. All right. So courage or cringe, mandatory ID verification to bring bad actors to light, or another potential attack on consumer privacy for social platforms that already know way too much?
You know what I was thinking about is... I started off thinking this is really stupid, and this is another kind of out of touch celebrity, you know. But just having you read it and the conversation that we had earlier, well, my position on the conversation around the Trump lawsuit of big tech, uh-huh. and that it could also be a forcing mechanism to look at a different classification for these companies, maybe not full utility, but maybe not just regular private company.
Right.
Makes me think, in the context of a reclassification, potentially, it could actually work. So think of like your phone number, right? I mean, back in the day, people had landlines, right?
Right. You think about like phone book kind of
like
system,
phone book or also like caller ID, right? I call somebody. They're like, sure. This is this person calling me. I've got their number. I know who they are, right? But that company who is enabling that caller ID is not a, you know, sort of standard private company, right? They're like a utility.
Right.
So maybe, so that's one thought. The other thought is, why do we want to know people's identities? The reason for that, okay, I think, is because you want to be able to go say, like, I want this person to know that somebody can come knock on their house, on their door.
Well, I think in this case, the reason he's saying that is basically to make it where I was like, hey, if you're going to say something, then you need to stand by what you say. And you can't just hide under usernames, right? Now,
right,
part of the stand by what you say could mean, to your point, someone to come and knock on your door. Or simply just say, even if it's on just social media, like
we
I know
who you are.
We know who you are, or you are going to attach this self. So whatever repercussions come from you being the case, for you doing this, is it's going to be easier for them to come forward. It's going to be like very public, right? This is a little bit in the category of cancel culture, right? People that have lost jobs, that have, you know, lost opportunity because of something stupid that they did in most cases. And something like this will definitely make it easier, right? If you say something like this, you go after people, then you're putting your reputation on the line because it is actually tied to your actual name, not just a username.
Increasingly, though, are personas online closer to your actual name than they used to be? I mean, like,
I think it depends on the platform.
Okay.
Think about things like Reddit and things like that. Not then, no.
Yeah.
I think it depends. It depends on the platform.
Okay. Yeah.
But even the platform, it's not an ID verification. You're adding that stuff in there.
Right. But the intent is to instill a check that is based somehow on fear or concern for your safety, be it or well-being, let's say, be it professional or physical. That's the threat of you knowing who the person is. Otherwise, why would it matter?
Well, it's like the matter is reputation, I would say. Right? It's like it actually ties to your actual reputation. Like,
great. So what is
you say something, then it's whatever you said is tied back to you as a person. Like,
right,
it's not just some
right
made up thing where, look, I know people that would create accounts, troll accounts, to be able and just harass people. No, I knew people that I worked with. Like, this, I'm not talking about people that are like fringe people that are like sitting there in the basement. No. Like,
what makes you think people you work with are not fringe people?
Well, Yeah, exactly right. But people that I knew in work settings who had multiple kind of troll accounts that they would use specifically to harass certain people. And really where he's coming from is the context of getting rid of trolls. Trolls who purposely are looking to hide their identity so that they can go and do as much damage as they want on social media. By the way, I'm making his argument a little bit here, but I'm just kind of giving you the positions.
Do you think that Idris Elba would give us his ID?
Idris Elba had to give his idea in order for him to be able to have a verified account. That's his point. That's actually where he's coming from. He's like, we already do it now. That's why all the verified accounts.
He's a blue check mark.
That's right. So all of the verified accounts already go through that process. Like, he can't just say something on his account. I mean, he could go create a fake account or a troll account, right? But what he's saying is, if I say something as Idris Elba, you know it's me, because I had to go through that process in order to have a little check mark next to it. I'm simply saying everyone else should go to the same process.
Don't we have the same feeling that we do about IDs for voting would be a problem if we're asking for IDs for social media? Like,
yeah, potentially, but you could always say,
isn't that going to disenfranchise a bunch of people?
Yeah, you could. I hadn't thought about that argument. Maybe.
I'm saying I'm sure slightly tongue in cheek.
No.
I don't think there'd be a problem with either. But go ahead.
I think you could have ways to solve for that, right? In terms of having some kind of verification, right? But the point here, the spirit of it is like the actual having to verify identity.
All right, I'm having a little bit of fun with Mr. Elba. Here's what I would say. So it's a cringe for me, but I'm going to qualify it by saying that in the context of a reclassification of these companies to something other than the duality of it's a government thing or a private company, but to some kind of communications utility, I could see something like this actually being part of the makeup of how these companies work.
Okay.
Just like the phone company.
Yeah.
So, but it's a cringe as is. I think it's kind of unworkable, and I think it has a lot of problems in it. But again, made me think.
Yeah, I think he brings up a really good point. I really do. I think he brings a really good point in terms of why he's... I think his reasons for the why make sense to me as to what he's trying to solve for, right? Is saying, hey, if you're going to basically to solve for the issue of people that are just out there just to troll and use the sort of the privacy of social media to facilitate their trolling, right? So I understand that. The reason why I'm cringe is because there's too much downside to going down this route, right? I think there is a big privacy issue that I'm very concerned about. Because now you're starting, it's not just about adults, because if you start going down this route, then where is the cutoff point? So you're saying 18 and over, 21 and over. You know, most social platforms are 13 plus, right? So how are you going to handle that, right? So you got to start thinking about that kind of issue. I also think adding more personal identifying information to these social platforms that are already struggling with having too much personal identifying information, I just think it's a problem. I have a fundamental issue with that point. And I also think that it opens up what you started with. It opens up a scenario where people are going to be more exposed. I think more, not so much about a guy going and getting beat up for saying something stupid. I get more worried about stalking women, people that could be harmed by people trying to like get to them in some way or another, whether they've done anything at all. I'm going to talk about the people that have went in and created a bunch of issues and now, you know, are getting sort of medicine of that they created. But the people that could be potentially harmed by this. So I think there's just too much downside. I understand his frustration. I understand his point. And he's coming from a person that they have to go through that, right, as they go there. So I understand where he's coming from, but I think there's just way too many downsides and going down that route that he's suggesting.
Well, as a person without a blue check, so I didn't even know the process of how you go and become verified or certified. But I agree with what you said, although presumably, again, and if you think about reclassifying these companies, you could have an opt-out like you do on the phone company to have an unlisted number or to block your caller ID or something like that.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's fundamental. It's the larger question, kind of like with the lawsuit thing. It's like we're not asking the larger question. We're not just trying to like patch the duct tape on the kind of, you know, this like
right. Well, an issue
multi-headed hydra that we have to figure out.
Privacy of having social platforms, knowing way too much. It's not just privacy, but using that data to hook people more into consuming things, into targeting things for different things. I just think it just creates too many downstream issues.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, that's good. 3 for 3. That's another rarity. Well, that's been a special day when we have to do more remotes.
I apologize to everyone.
We have to do more remotes.
Who's on my side typically. Sorry. I will be better next time.
I apologize
time.
To them too. Thank you. Awesome. Any other, anything else, Jesus?
No, it's fun.
We have a fun show next week. We got Joe Collins on the show.
Joe Collins, yes.
It's going to be very interesting.
For those that don't know who Joe Collins is, you want to tell people who Joe Collins is?
Joe Collins is a guy who ran against Maxine Waters here in the 43rd District in Los Angeles for Congress, right?
Right.
The 43rd District in Congress. And he had one of these crazy viral videos.
The best attack ad I've seen in my life. And most hilarious.
He's a black Republican. I'm not sure if he's conservative. We'll find out where his ideology is. But he's a black Republican who ran against Maxine Waters. And he ran this crazy spot that got like millions of views where he basically sat outside her house. We'll talk about it. But anyway, it's going to be fun to have him on the show. And he's done a whole bunch of other media. He's been on, you know, Fox and other places a million times. So it'll be very interesting. So he's on the show next week. Looking forward to that. We got some fun shows coming up. So it's going to be really good. I'll just remind you guys, as always, remember to subscribe. Hit up patreon.com/thediversityremix. I always get that wrong.
I don't know.
patreon.com/thediversityremix to support the work that we do. As always, it takes time, energy, and money to run this thing. So we appreciate your support. And looking forward to seeing you again.
One last thought, actually.
Yeah, please.
I just thought about it, which is we didn't talk about it.
Yeah,
exactly. We didn't talk about this at the beginning of the episode, but you know, a lot of our thoughts are with what's happening in Cuba. Like, it's a really difficult situation that is going on right there. There's people who are desperately looking for more freedom, more rights. And we purposely did not talk about it in this episode because we want to talk about it next week when we have Joe Collins on. Kind of getting his perspective, but it is, I think for those that are not as aware, I would just encourage you to just find out, read up on it, you know, and hopefully get different perspectives. But it's an issue that has been going on, obviously, for the last, you know, 50, 60 years. And they're in a really, really tough place. So anytime you see people suffer like that, it's just, you know, I think our heart is with them, and hopefully there's a little better place for them as they go forward.
Absolutely. Well said. Yeah, we'll talk more about that next week. Lots on Cuba and a bunch of other fun stuff next week. But in the meantime, keep listening, subscribe, and we'll see you guys again next time on TDR. If you enjoyed this episode of the Diversity Remix, please remember, first of all, to subscribe and help us to spread the word. Tell your friends, family, coworkers, and give us a 5-star review. We're available on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else you get your listening fix. And lastly, please remember to stop by blackbrown.us, the creator of this podcast, and take a look at our work and our approach at the intersection of diversity and business. The Diversity Remix is produced by Leo Gomez, with production services by Jose Manuel Durquidi and Luis Diego Carranza and our friends at Juan Diego Network. The Diversity Remix is a production of Black Brown.